You're listening to How Yoshi Did It Podcast with Yoshi Obayashi. Don't you ever All right, welcome to the new episode of Yoshi Den. I'm here with my great friend, Brad Upton. Brad, I don't know, for those of you not from Seattle, there's three or four guys. You're one of those three or four legends up here. And you're too modest, like our good friend Kermit Appeal, but it's you, Kermit Appeal, and Rod Long for me. And of course, our mutual friend. He's very underrated, and some people might have forgot, but Tana Manu.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, all four of you guys are, and of course, there's Dwayne Goh, and I love Hennigan and those guys, but you and Kermit and Rod Long.
Well, thanks. Trifecta, you know. I appreciate being in that group of guys.
Because I'm always shocked when I hear about things about you and Kermit, and I can't emphasize enough, if you guys were a little bit shameless, you know, you should have been on Tonight Show 20 years ago, you know, Letterman, things like that. It's not lack of ambition, but I think, once again, lack of shamelessness. That's
well, I always felt like, and I realize now it wasn't true. I always felt like, well, if you just do your job, they'll find you and they'll take care. You know what I mean? You'll get on those things because they'll recognize that you should be on there, or you're that good to be on there, and they'll take care of themselves. Those things will happen for you. They don't. You got to go out there and push for them or chase them down. But I would agree, yeah.
Because, you know, the fact that I just find out that I think you told me this 2-3 years ago, you never had a manager, and you used to open for Joan Rivers, you just working for her, you should have gone to Montreal or something like that. But you never bothered those people, right?
I worked with the Smothers Brothers quite a bit too. Way. Tommy probably would have made calls for me if I would have asked.
Yeah.
He always asked me the same thing. Why aren't you a bigger deal?
Yeah.
He always asked me that. You should be a bigger deal. I'm like, well, thanks.
I mean, before we get into detail, you know, you work with a lot of big names, and but I want to... We'll start. Like, you were born, raised in where? Washington State?
Yes, in Richland, over in the Tri-Cities.
Oh, okay.
That's where I was born and raised.
And I'm assuming you do not come from an entertainment family,
no,
show business.
No. Okay. Dad owned a car rental franchise. Mom worked at Safeway.
I see. So when did you decide you want to be stand-up in entertainment business? How does that happen in Richland?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because I always liked stand-ups. I always liked them when I saw them on TV back in Johnny Carson. Even when I was younger than that, back in the 60s and stuff, when you'd see guys on TV, I always liked the stand-ups. And then I always really was drawn to those stand-ups. And I wanted to do it, but you never think, when you're living in Richland, you don't think you're ever going to do it. But when I was in college, I kept thinking, wow, I'd like to try it. I'd like to try it.
You went to the University of Washington?
No, I went to Spokane Community College. And then 1 year at University of Montana, and then 2 years at Eastern Washington University. Okay. So I really wanted to go, and I saw some comics live at the time. I saw George Carlin in Spokane, then I saw Al Franken, and Franken and Davis went out as a team, and I saw those guys in college. I saw Andy Kaufman in college. He came to Eastern Washington. I saw him live. So I always thought, oh, that'd be great to do that. And I started wishing I could do it. But, you know, and then I got out of college. I started teaching school in Pasco. So you don't know how you're going to make it.
High school or?
I taught grade school.
Okay.
And then I wanted to do it.
To heckling.
Yeah. Well, I told people, you know, I was teaching 10-year-olds. I was teaching fourth grade. So when I started doing comedy, I told people. And it's true. Entertaining a room full of drunks and a bunch of 10-year-olds, that's not a big career change.
Right.
It's the same thing. And so I just decided I wanted to try it. But the only place to do it was over here in Seattle. So I drove over here and signed up for an open mic. And that was I actually signed up in 1983. And I drove all the way over here. And it was almost my turn to go up. And I chickened out. And I told the MC to take me off. And he goes, you sure you're going up in a couple more? I go, no, I don't want to do it. I just chickened out. And I drove home And I waited a year. I just hated myself for the whole year because I chickened out because I'd gotten all set to do my first set. So then the next year, in September of 84, I drove over and signed up for an open mic. And it was actually the it was an audition for the Seattle Comedy Competition.
But so this was at the Comedy Underground,
Yeah, the Comedy Underground. And I truly didn't know it was anything other than open mic.
Yeah.
But it was an audition that night. And I killed the first time I got on stage. Just killed. And the back then, the Comedy Underground would be packed on a Tuesday night for open mic. It was packed,
right?
And the audience was hot, and it was packed. And I killed the first time I got on stage. So Laura Crocker said, "We thought you were great. We want you to do the comedy competition." And I was like, "What?
What?"
She goes, "Well, you're in." And I go, "Yeah, I don't, what? In what?" She goes, "Well, you passed the audition." "What audition? Is this open mic?" I said, "I thought this was open mic. I didn't know what I'd just done."
Right.
She goes, "It is, but it was also an audition for the comedy competition. We thought you were great. We want you to be in the comedy competition." So after my first time on stage, bang, I'm in the Seattle Comedy Competition. And then it wasn't so good after that.
Yeah.
I finished 18th out of 20 the first week.
But, I mean, let's be honest. That's amazing.
Yeah. That I passed the audition the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah. That I must have, I mean, Laura knew what she was doing, that I looked competent enough or relaxed enough to put me in the competition.
That's like hitting a grand slam at first at bat, really.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
By the way, Laura used to be, well, a wife of Ron Reed, and she passed away. But she was an institution up here.
Yeah, and, she had a bunch of work and a bunch of one-nighters.
So, I mean, you drove from Tri-City. So you figure move to Seattle, right?
I'm assuming
that's... Okay.
Yeah, so that was for the next 2 years. I either drove over here to get on stage or I drove up to Spokane. They had an open mic in Spokane on Sunday nights. And I would go up there. And then by that time, a couple of one-nighters had started in the Tri-Cities in bars.
Yeah.
So I started going over there and doing guest sets at those gigs. So I didn't do a lot of... I didn't do a lot of stage time. But within 7 months, I got asked to do a half hour, and I went, "Yeah, I can do 30 minutes." And I got hired to do a gig up in Idaho, and then two nights in Spokane. So I had 30 minutes within 7 months of being on stage, and I got paid. And then the next year, I did the Spokane Comedy Competition, and I was still teaching school, and I was working with guys that I felt like I'm as good as they are, and they're doing it professionally. So I went, "I'm going to quit teaching and see what happens." So that's been 30 years.
Jesus.
Since I quit teaching.
Yeah, it was so clear to everyone that you had talent. And like, even the people I talked about, you know, in the early 80s and stuff. And I mean, how would you explain to listeners, like, sounds like there was a lot of work in the 80s.
There was a lot of work in the 80s. I mean, even around here, Laura, who we just mentioned, she had about 3 weeks of one-nighters right here in Puget Sound. Tuesday through Saturday Wednesday through Sunday. Just bar gigs around here. So you could get 3 weeks from Laura and stay right here. And then they had the Comedy Underground and Giggles was around.
Sure.
So there was 5 weeks of work right in town.
And did you... So when did you start getting out of the state? Like, I mean, I just find out during lunch that you've done tons of overseas gigs, you know. So that's... You have a little bit of challenge, right? The audience must be a little different.
Oh, when you go overseas?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've performed in Australia, and I've done a couple of casinos and corporate events, and then some clubs and one-nighters in Australia, and then in Singapore and Hong Kong. Singapore and Hong Kong, well, not so much Singapore, but Hong Kong, it's mostly expats.
Yeah.
But, again, they're Australian, South African, British, New Zealanders, and just English-speaking. They're not necessarily Americans. There are some Americans. But yeah, you find out right away which bits just don't transfer. But I've lucky enough, my material has worked everywhere I've went. I'm like, I don't have a plan B, so here's what I got. And luckily it works.
And I don't know how to explain it because I'm sure you had situation like this, like jokes that are right over here, some reason it's bigger laughter overseas and vice versa.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
I do a joke about trail mix, the origins of trail mix.
Yeah.
And that joke went thud a couple of nights in Australia, and the person I was working with said, "Tell me that joke you do about trail mix." So I told him. They went, "Yeah, we really don't have that product here in Australia. There's just It just doesn't exist, and nobody knows it as Trails Mix, and, you know, it just didn't work.
Yeah.
So when I was talking about Trail Mix, people were like, they didn't know what the hell I was talking about. So I just dropped that bit.
Oh, you just make a little bit of change.
And yeah, you have to explain it a little differently, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, looking back, you must be surprised, right? Like, if somebody told you a day before you did your first stand-up, that you're going to be over 30 different countries, and not to mention some of the biggest name and entertainers you're doing the show. That must be science fiction almost, right?
Yeah, and you sometimes you look at it and think, wow, I've accomplished everything I wanted to do, almost everything I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So, but it never occurred to me, you know, and I've told people it never occurred to me I wasn't going to succeed at it. When I started, I went, I'm going to be a comedian. I just felt like I was going to do it. It never occurred to me that I wasn't going to succeed. So I've always planned on being successful. I don't know if I'm successful now, but I've made my living doing it for 30 years. So I guess that's successful in this business.
I know for a fact you're successful, but I guess the question myself and others have is, it's true. You should be way bigger, you know, you and Kermit, you know. The way I explain to Kermit to a lot of people, if they've never met him, let's say in the heyday, Ray Romano, his show, he dies.
Right.
And they could just put Kermit in his spot, and
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Show would be fine. He's mm-hmm. one of those kind of guys.
Like, right.
Because you two, you know, the thing that I keep hearing from other veteran comedians, like they always say, Ray Romano and Jerry Seinfeld, normal guys, no issues, healthy guys with no darkness at all. You know?
Right.
I feel the same thing about you and Kermit.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment on both of us.
Yeah.
I think so. And the other thing, but comparing Kermit and I, we appeal, and I never did this on purpose, but we appeal to a wide range of ages. 20-somethings enjoy Kermit's act, and so do 80-year-olds.
Yeah.
And I found the same way. I've had people, 20-somethings going out going, oh, man, when you first walked out, I thought, oh, man, this dude's old.
Yeah.
But, man, you killed it. You were great. I really enjoyed it.
Right.
So I'm always happy when I hear 20-somethings tell me how much they enjoyed my show. That really makes me feel good.
I think it's because you guys really work hard in your act and material. Because, you know, I'm sure you listen to Woody Allen's thing. I mean, you might have a really weird feeling by him as a man, but
right.
as a stand-up, his stuff doesn't feel dated at all.
Right.
You could listen to it today, and then like mm-hmm. it's the world-crafted jokes. And I think, and I know for a fact, both of you guys don't make compromise. You know, you don't do pandering stuff.
No,
that kind of shit get really dated. You
oh
know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, over the years, you know, me and Brody and Tana Manu, whenever we talk about Seattle Comics, you know, this is not let's kiss Brad and Kermit's asses, but yeah, we really appreciate because you're professional at what you did and what you do, and you're very kind to all the. I mean, to this day, even if you meet somebody new, I know for a fact you're good to them. So
yeah, well, it's just I mean, in life, you should be nice to people. How's that? How's that ever not going to pay off? Yeah, I think so too. Those you and Brody and Tana and God, that was fun watching.
Yeah, I think Brody was more serious about career, but me and Tana thought it was just fun. It really was a fun thing to do, and I know it sounds silly, but some of the kids in LA, it takes a whole career, and you know they forget the fun part. So,
oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
gotta have fun. There's times I even now, probably more now than ever, right in the middle of my show sometimes, I think to myself, this is great.
Yeah.
I mean, I have that thought while I'm on stage sometimes. And I'm not sure I ever did that much when I started out. But now I can be on stage and having a great show going, this is great. I get to do this. I think I appreciate it more now than when I started.
And I think probably my problem when I started, and a lot of the shitheads during the show, we were very childish, but it's okay to have that childlike wonder about doing stand-up. You know, it is fun. I mean, I did a room called Local 907 2 days ago. I think I was a little too dark, but yesterday mm-hmm. I did Olympia, and Dave Williams go last, and great audience. I've always liked kind of like the working class, down to earth people. You know, they just work all day. They just want to have a beer and just a laugh.
Right.
And those are my favorite. And done shows in Europe, people like that, in Australia, New Zealand. And I'm very grateful. It is a fun job for most part.
You know? Yeah, I had a great, you know, when I went to Australia, that was the first time I went over and worked overseas. And I went on stage hoping, God, I hope I don't suck. I never thought, oh my God, I'm going to just crush, which I did. I just killed. And I was like, whoa. Go, yeah, this is great. I'm not sucking, and not only am I not sucking, I'm killing it. So that was fun. But I realized now I'm the guy with the accent. You know how an Australian comic comes to the U.S., the audience likes him because he has that endearing accent.
Sure.
Well, I'm that guy now in Australia.
And they must love the material. And
Yeah.
So I know you've done shows. I mean, you've done everything, just about military, cruise, and, you know, weekend at any club in the country. But how was it? Well, how did you meet Joan, and what was it like working for her?
I just got booked at a casino over in Spokane through an agency. They needed a opener.
For her?
For her.
Okay.
And I went over there and had a great show.
When was this about?
It was probably 10 years ago. And then I didn't work with her for a couple of years. And then I don't know where the second one must have been, over here somewhere around Tacoma or something.
I see.
And then she goes, oh, I remember you. And then I had a great show. And she goes, listen, I thought you were great. I loved you. Just call my agents in L.A., tell them that you're approved by Joan, and let's do some more of these. I'm fantastic. So she gave me that number, and I started calling the agency down there and spoke in L.A. And then when they meshed up with my schedule, she had two or three other people that were opening for
her. I see.
But I did a bunch of them. I did like Chicago and Kansas City and Minneapolis and Austin, Texas, and couple of casinos in the Midwest. So I did a bunch of shows with her.
So, I mean, isn't it true? It must have been weird for you, right? Because this is someone you used to watching TV.
Oh, yeah.
Even before you were thinking about doing comedy, right?
Oh, way back when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
Same way when I worked with the Smothers Brothers.
Yeah.
Hanging out with them and working with them. And you think, these guys, I mean, they had the number one TV show in America when I was 12 years old.
Not to mention, they were pretty controversial back then,
yeah.
Right? Political stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they were on President Nixon's enemy list or something.
He got them fired off of CBS. He got that show canceled because they were so anti-war and making fun of him and the war. And the Nixon talked to CBS, got him fired. They got fired. And they sued and won. But it was 10 years later. They didn't get their show back. But it was about 10 years later when that finally went through and they won.
I can't even imagine these days that some president going network.
Yeah, exactly. And then can you imagine a network canceling a number one show? They'd never do it. That's what they, because of content. If it was number one, they wouldn't care. But yeah, the very first night I ever worked at the Smothers Brothers, me and Tommy and their sound guy ended up just getting drunker than hell, and I was like, this is great. I'm sitting with Tommy, I'm just hammered with Tommy Smothers. This is great. We drank a whole fifth of scotch, three of us.
So you open for those two, you do your time, you get off, they go up. What do they, I mean, is it like, it's not a stand-up, right? They're just talking to each other.
Well, yeah, they come on from each side.
Yeah.
And then they come out, and you know, it's the Smothers Brothers. It's half music, half comedy, and it was phenomenal to watch. You know how when you're on stage and you're performing and you're doing a bit, and all of us can take our bits, and you can shorten them or lengthen them depending on the feedback from the audience.
Absolutely.
You know how you can do that with a bit. It was fascinating to watch those guys work, and they could do the same thing, but it's two of them.
Right.
And they just understood each other enough that we're doing the long version or the short version. You know, it was fascinating to watch. Because they're brothers, and they do cues to each other, and
And they've been doing it for so long.
And they've been doing it so long. They just can make those calls. Like you and I can call an audible all the time on stage. But they would do it as a duo. And I don't think, unless you've ever done stand-up, how amazing that is, that two guys thinking with one, two brains is one.
Yeah. How long did you work for them?
Do you still do it? No, they retired about 3 years ago. They quietly retired. They didn't announce it. They just took their last booking and then never took any bookings after that. And I did about 20 shows with them as well over about a 2.5 year period.
I see. And this is a common theme with you. You never asked them to call in for a favor.
No, I didn't ask for any favors. But
this is something that we need to work on next year.
Now I realize I should have, apparently, because Tommy would have done it, I think.
Yeah.
And I think Joan would have, too.
That's, I definitely want to help you with that. It's not like I have a poll, but I know a couple people that you should definitely meet them and do shows with them.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But going back to Joan, you were telling me stuff about her. I feel so stupid because I think I had a couple chances to go see her, but I just assume, I got shit to do this week. And I'm never going. I mean, to me, she's a comedy version of like David Bowie or something. You know, somebody that you should have seen.
Oh, absolutely. She was such a great comic. That's what the first time I worked, every night when I worked with her, I was just blown away how good a comic that she is. You know, everybody knows the personality and knows her from some of the shows, but live, she'd come out and do 70 minutes, and she'd come out, and the crowd would roar when she'd walk out.
Yeah.
And she'd just hit the ground running and joke for 70 minutes. Just killing it. She was a great comic. I was so impressed with how good she was.
And she worked really hard, and I remember watching the documentary. She literally had a cabinet full of jokes that she kept over the years, and she just kept adding more and more stuff. And, you know, you could go like, section code under D, divorce. She's got thousands of divorce jokes and cosmic surgery or whatnot. And she was really professional, you know. I mean, I don't think people realize how hard she worked at it. And, you know, we talked about this during lunch. If you think female comics have a tough time now, I can't imagine when she started.
Oh, she must have been up against it. It must have been horrible for her. The other thing that amazed me about Joan, too, is she had a room in New York City that she did every Tuesday night.
I didn't know that.
And it was just so that she keep sharp. You know what I mean? It was called the Sewing Room, I think.
Okay.
And it was in New York City, and she did it every Tuesday night when she wasn't work, just to stay sharp. She knew that, you know, comedy is a skill like anything else. If you got to keep getting on stage and performing, even if you've done it for 50 years.
Sure.
You want to work out every week, and you don't want to take 3 weeks off, because then when you come back, you're a little rusty. And maybe the audience doesn't see it, but you certainly feel it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And
I was always impressed that she went to that little room in New York City every Tuesday night and did her set.
And she was so fabulously rich that she could retire. But
oh, yeah.
It wasn't about money, though, to her.
No.
She really liked
working. She was still driven. Yeah, absolutely.
And if I remember, didn't she die from complication plastic surgery or something?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, I think what happened is I think there was a reaction and her throat started to swell, I think. And then that, because it was an outpatient facility.
Yeah.
And they didn't know how to handle the emergency situation, I believe. I think that's what happened.
Fuck.
Yeah. And that was it. And then they panicked, and then human error, like every other time something like that happens.
Yeah.
And then everybody trying to cover their own ass. So that's what happened.
I mean, she really was. If you're a fan of stand-up comedy, she really was national treasure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there's tradition of Jewish women doing comedy, but I love her and Sarah Silverman for sure. And I think, you know, I think Amy Schumer's continuing the tradition of that, but
Joan would have a shot of vodka before she'd go out every night too.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, just a shot, just one little one shot.
Because did you see the episode Louie? She was on the
no, one when she slept with him, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that? Yeah, no, I didn't see. I've heard of it, but no, I didn't see the episode.
It was great because it was an episode, if I remember right, Louie's having a tough time, and he was doing his show within that TV show, and he might have done a joke that they didn't like. I don't know. Something happened where he got fired. So he's at a casino. He was angry that he got fired. And he noticed Joan was performing in a bigger room.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I don't know, after the show, they talk. And complain about things are not going well. And she was saying, look, I might be working big room today, but tomorrow I might have to work in little room. You know, we should be very grateful that we work in this business,
right.
You know. And sometimes we forget that part, you know. And I'm glad I came up this week. I did, I don't know, 4 or 5 shows. It's really fun doing shows in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, granted, last year when I opened for Dave Attell, me and him, even Dave was surprised how cringy the audience were with some of the material.
Right, but here?
At the Parlor in downtown Seattle.
Oh,
but
yeah?
You're going specifically Attell, so you should know what you're getting into.
Exactly.
But I was really taken back with that yuppie element that everyone used to that material. But I thought maybe entire Pacific Northwest. Thank God it wasn't. I went down to Olympiad and what a great audience. They just want to laugh and they know you're just joking. So Joan, you did that. Who's some other Smothers Brothers? And you work with a bunch of other big names.
Well, I've been opening for Johnny Mathis for the last 8 years too, and those are great gigs. And you know who he is?
Oh yeah.
Okay,
I've seen him at. I think I've seen him twice when he does Christmas time during Jay Leno's Tonight Show.
Mm-hmm.
Man, what an amazing
Well, Jay used to have the same job I did. Jay used to open for him.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and that's why Jay would still call him. He always calls him boss because he used to. Jay had the same slot I have now and did the same thing. He opened for Johnny for a number of years. So when he had his own show, he made sure he had Johnny on every year at Christmas.
Oh, that's why.
Yeah. And so he'd always have, and then you'd see him at the end. He'd walk over and go, hey, boss. He'd always call him, hey, boss. But yeah.
Well, how did you get that gig, and what's it like working for a musical act? It must be a little different or same.
It is, and the cool thing about it is I actually go up in the middle of the show. It's really smart. Johnny Mathis, you go to a Johnny Mathis show, he comes out beginning of the show, and he sings for about 40, 42 minutes.
Yeah.
And then he says, ladies and gentlemen, one of the great things about this business, I get to work with, I've met a lot of fun people and neat people, and I want to introduce you to somebody right now. He goes, I'm going to go in and change a suit. I got another suit I want you to see. And he goes, I'm going to go off for a few minutes. I'm going to bring my very funny friend out here. You're going to join him. Please welcome Brad Upton. And then I walk out.
Right.
And I do 25 minutes. And then we go to intermission. And then he comes back out and he sings the second half. So between me and the intermission, he sings 40 minutes. He has a 45-minute rest. Then he sings for 45 minutes.
I know. I just assume you just come in the beginning of the show.
Yeah, you would think. And it's really great. I mean, it's really a good format.
Yeah.
And it. He told me, he said, the reason I do it that way, he goes, I went to a concert way back when I first started, and the headliner didn't show up, and the audience just rioted. He goes, so I always want the audience to know I'm here. That's why I came out first. I want the audience to know I'm here. So he goes, that's why I started doing that. And then he goes, I just liked it. It's really kind of cool. And then I've told people this too. This is what's great. I go, this must be what it's like to be famous. Because when Johnny Mathis, all these people that love Johnny Mathis, they paid all this money to see Johnny Mathis. And when he tells the audience, here's a friend of mine that you're going to like.
Yeah.
I walk out, they already like me. Because, you know, you and I, when we go on stage every night, we have to prove ourselves every night.
Sure.
Because the audience is like, I don't know this guy. What do you got? But when Johnny Mathis says, here's my friend, that they already like me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
And then I do all this stuff about how dumb 20-somethings are.
Yeah.
And being married for a long time. And it's right in their wheelhouse. And it just kills. And these big, beautiful performing arts centers and theaters.
Once again, how, you know, I'm sure.
But I've never asked Johnny to call anybody for 8.5 years. I've never asked him to do anything for me.
I mean, I know that's not the reason why you got into business, but well, before we jump into that, I also want to talk about you've done TV and movies, but in one of the role, you played a track coach, right?
In Prefontaine?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
No, I auditioned for a spot in that movie as his high school track coach.
Oh, okay.
And then I got the part, and then they said, couple days later they call me up and they go, well, that part got written out of the final script, but we really liked your audition, so we're going to find something for you. And then a few days later they call me and I'm in the scene when he flips his car and I run out of the house and try and save his life,
and he dies from the car accident, right?
Yeah, right.
It's been a while since I've seen that. Yeah, but I
it's just me and Jared Leto in the scene. That's the scene, me and Jared Leto.
What was he like back in those days?
Jared Leto?
Yeah.
He was great. Yeah. And he could run, too, man. I'm telling you. The college kids here, there were some scenes where they were running, you know, they were recreating. And he ran a lot of miles and got real fit. And these college milers here at the University of Washington, they were trying to run him to death a little bit in some of the scenes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they said, man, he was great. He was fit. He ran really well. He goes, because we were trying to make it uncomfortable for him.
And when was that? Maybe 15 years ago?
20 years ago.
Is it 20?
20.
Boy, talk about a guy with a great movie career. Because this year, he's going to be in Suicide Squad.
Playing, is that Leto?
Yeah, he's going to play Joker in that thing.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be... It just. I mean, he what was that? He won the Oscar a couple years ago.
Yeah, a couple years ago.
Yeah, and terrific actor. And I also know that I know a lot of art friends, artists. I know he dabbles like stuff in Silicon Valley and art collections. So he's a really interesting guy. But
yeah, when he won that Oscar, I was telling my family where I was sitting there. I go, yeah, I've done a scene with the Oscar winner, me and him, just the two of us.
What did they say?
They're like, yeah, whatever. I'm like, have you? Yeah, yeah, have you? I've done it. Me and an Oscar, just he and I, Oscar winner. I probably stole the scene. I said, I go, he was just laying there gasping. I had all the lines, which is true. He was just laying there trying not to die, and I'm screaming for help.
God damn, it's been 20 years. It just
seemed I can't believe it. I know. I still get checks for that thing, too.
You do?
Yeah, they're like a dollar. About four a year. I make about $4 a year off that thing.
The reason I brought that scene is because you still coach, right?
Right. I've always coached. In the, you know, some guys golf and some guys fish, and I still coach high school kids.
So is that when you were a kid, you realized you were really talented at running and doing different track events? And I mean, you were telling me you competed until your mid-30s, didn't you?
Right. And I ran in high school, and then I ran in college, and then I continued to compete after college. Because in track, people don't know this about track. If you're, you know, when you're done playing college baseball, you're done, or college basketball, you're done, unless you go to the pros. But in track, you can just keep training, and I would call these track meet, these coaches around the Northwest, and go, I want to run the 110-meter high hurdles on Saturday, and they go, fine, we'll give you a lane. And as long as you're competitive and fit, and they'll let you run, you just run unattached. You don't run with, you know, you run with whatever you want. And
yeah.
Because the colleges want the field to be stronger. It's better if the field's stronger for their athletes. If they're running against, you know, if you suck, they're not going to put you in the race. But, you know, by that time I was pretty good, and I ran my fastest time of my life when I was 30.
Wow.
And that was the same year I quit teaching to start doing stand-up. So there was about a 6 years there where I competed in track and field and was doing stand-up. But I always coached on the side, too. At that point, I just started helping other hurdlers.
Yeah.
And it turned into a coaching career.
I mean, how did you learn to do that? Just through your experience? Or did you have really good coaches that teach you tips?
I just jumping over them in high school one day in PE class, and I could do it better than the other guys. Because hurdling's not a normal, it's not a intuitive motion.
Yeah.
People want to jump way too high over the hurdle and use both legs. And the first few times I ever went over it, I went over it pretty well, looking back. But it's not something most people are very good at right away. But I was pretty good at it. So I was like, oh, I'm better than the other guys at this. So, you know, when you're 14, 15 years old and you find something athletically that you're better at, then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I'm better than most of the other guys in this. So that's what I gravitated towards.
I see. And they were saying, like, you're one of the top-notch coach in the country.
I coached at the University of Washington for 10 years.
Yeah.
During my whole comedy career, I had a bunch of All-Americans there and school record holders, and I actually coached full-time for 3 years.
At UW?
At UW, where they paid me. I was the paid assistant, and what had happened in 93... I'd had some heat in the business. You know, I'd done Evening at the Improv and Comedy on the Road and MTV Half Hour Comedy Hour, and I was getting ready to, like, maybe we're going to move to L.A., and, you know, I had a little heat.
Yeah.
And at the same time, my wife and I were starting a family. We had a baby, and this was in April of 94. And at that point, I'd been coaching for 7 years at the UW, just as a volunteer. When I was in town, I would go help the hurlers. Sure. When I wasn't there, I wasn't there. But I'd had success for 7 years as a volunteer assistant. But the day after my son was born, 24 hours later, my wife was diagnosed with kidney cancer and given a 50% chance to live.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so all of a sudden, I had heat. I was headlining for the Improvs, yeah, around the country, and I had just done 3 TV shows. And then all of a sudden, I had what I thought was a brand new baby and a wife that was going to die. So yeah, I thought, I can't go on the road anymore. That's it for comedy. I'm done. So within 3 weeks, I took the job at the UW. I knew it was opening up, the assistant job,
sure,
but I wasn't interested in it. I was just going to keep volunteering. But immediately, I went to the coaching staff. I explained what happened. I go, if that job's available, I'd like it. And I got it. So for the next 3 years, I coached full-time. I didn't tell anybody in the comedy business, but I still was doing gigs around Puget Sound here.
Yeah, yeah.
And a few gigs on the road. They let me travel a little bit and take some corporate events, things like that. But my wife was fine. I mean, she survived the surgery. She lost her kidney, and then that's been 22 years ago, so she's still fine. We had another kid. But at the time, like I was started to, I didn't move to L.A. I was headlining all the Improvs. Yeah. I just quit calling them for dates, and then for 3 years. So all that momentum that I had in my career, just for 3 years, I didn't really leave Puget Sound. And then I went back to coaching. I mean, going back to comedy full-time in 97, and by then you call up the Improvs. Oh, there's somebody new booking. Can you send us a tape? Yeah. You know, that crap. So it was almost like starting over again.
I had no idea, because I think part of the reason is because you never talk about your problem on stage or anything.
No,
you know,
cancer's not a I haven't found the funny part of that yet either. But yeah, it was too hard to talk about too for a while. Even now, sometimes I tell that story. I don't know why. Sometimes it's a hard story to tell, but sometimes it's not.
Well, God, I got to be careful how I say this.
Oh, go ahead.
Because sometimes I it was really weird, because sometimes, you know, people go up and say, hey, I've been sober for like 5 years or whatever, and everybody clap, right?
Right.
But there's part of me thinking like, well, I've never been a drunk, so I should be getting more credit than I. And but they don't like that, you know.
Right.
And you know, it's cynical business, man. Because you don't know when somebody's genuinely sick and when they're not, and exploiting their situation, you know.
Oh yeah. Well, I have a joke now that I love, and it's based on that. And I always say to the audience, I go, "I'll tell you a little bit myself. I am recently a widower."
Yeah.
In the audience, you can hear me. Oh, you can hear me. Oh, and I go, if everything went as planned, I look at my watch. You know, but I suck them in right there. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're kind of pissed that I tricked them. You know, but sometimes it gets a good laugh. I mean, it always gets a good laugh, because I look at my watch and go, if everything went as planned.
Because I have to say, sometimes being funny doesn't help you if you're a white guy. I'll be honest right here.
Yeah.
You know, and they have a black show, Asian show, but why don't you just have a funny show, you know?
Right, exactly.
And sometimes people feel like they have a representation. Like, my friend Ruben had a show over the weekend. They canceled it because somebody forgot to get a permit for alcohol or something.
Oh, wow.
But somebody complained that, hey, by the way, there's no woman on the show. And believe me, I know Ruben for 30 years. He didn't do it on purpose.
Right.
And personally, I don't really give a shit. You know, I just want to have a funny show. But yeah, it's really weird when there's demands like that are made sometime, you know?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, sometimes somebody's not available. I mean, who books a show based on? You just want to know who the funny people are that are available, and then let's put them together.
But you would think that, but there's a lot of weird things like, this show we have to have a minimum 3 women per show. Like, what?
Yeah. You know?
So it's different, but now I'm curious. I know for a fact you're a funny guy and you have talent. I just want to know, you must have a new I know you reach all the things you want to do, but I want to know where you want to go from here, because I'm surprised you and Kermit is not on TV all the time.
Well, I've never done a late night TV spot ever on any show. Yeah. Kermit hasn't either. And
is that something you want
to
do?
Yeah, I'd love to do a late night TV spot, but I think now I'm too old. They're not going to put me on it, I don't think. But and the only reason, and I've told people this, the only reason I want to do a late night TV spot is to
I think I know why.
Is to impress my two kids. I really do. That's, I mean, it's not going to change my career. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to change anything for me if I did Conan or Tonight Show.
Yeah.
But I want my kids to go, oh my God, Dad's
that's my
on.
Dad.
That's, you know, because they've seen a bunch of comics on TV. And my kids think that any comic on TV is better and more famous and richer than Dad. You know what I mean? And I always go, no, that's not the case. That's not the case. I probably make more money than that guy in a year.
And
well, how come you're not on TV? Well, because I'm not. I stayed here in this town and raised you guys.
Yeah.
I'm not in L.A., that's why. You know, I had a couple times when the kids were like in junior high and they'd have a bunch. One time, I went downstairs and my son and about five of his friends, they were all about 14 or 15, and they were watching a Christopher Titus special.
Yeah.
And I stood there and watched for a while, and I was laughing, and I think I said one of Titus's jokes before he finished it. And they go, how did you know that? I go, well, I've worked with him. I know him. You know him? They just like, I go, yeah, he threw up in the back seat of my car about 15 years ago. Oh, my, you know, they just think that everybody on TV is, I go, yeah, that's my peers. Those are my, why aren't you on TV? So all these boys start asking, how come you're not on TV? I go, well, because I live in Seattle. I'm not in L.A. But yeah, I'd like to do a late night TV show just so the kids can, oh my God, Dad's on.
Well, I want to definitely help, and you should come down more often.
Yeah.
And I know, sounds like obviously you're very proud of your kids, and your daughter sounds very talented writer.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I think you coming down to LA probably helps a lot too. It's going to be challenging.
Oh yeah.
But let's make it easier for her, because even if you write a good writings, if the right people don't read it, it doesn't do you any good, you know.
No, there's no guarantees. And you know, I was backing up a little bit. You were talking about me and Kermit should have done more television or been seen by more. But you know, there's no guarantees in any business. I always tell people this. You know, like in the fire department, there's 30 sergeants, and somebody gets promoted to lieutenant.
Yeah,
and then all the rest of the sergeants go, how the hell that guy? Well, because the captain liked him. I mean, there's no guarantees. And the same way in comedy, you know, guys that are great comics that, why isn't that guy a bigger deal? Well, I don't know. Just didn't get picked. He's as good as anybody else, but he's just not at a higher level. You know, part of it, you know, Kermit and I both live here in Seattle, so
I have family
and
too.
Raise families here, and that's, you know, that's going to keep you back a little bit, but there's no guarantees in any business. Somebody gets promoted at law firm into partner, and all the other lawyers are going, how'd he make partner?
Yeah.
Well, because the old guy at the top really likes him. And you get promoted, and that's just called life. So,
well, I know for a fact you have multiple skills in doing stand-up. I know you know how to do corporate gigs, road gigs,
right,
crews, and you know how to do showcase, but I don't know. I was wondering, like, I went to see the movie Dead Poets Society years ago,
mm-hmm,
and there's certain actors like, I know that guy's going to be a big star.
Right.
Doesn't work out. It was some other actors with the smaller roles became big. So how much of it is you're in control? I don't know. It seems like there is a bit of a luck involved too, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. Or lack of luck for some people.
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm confident my hour-long set is probably as, I don't want to say I'm as good as anybody, but I think my hours, I got a great hour show, I think, at this point. I mean, after 30 years, I'd love to do a Netflix or something like that, you know, one of those things.
Yeah.
I'm very confident. Like you said, I like working sometimes. I like still working a bar gig once in a while.
Yeah.
It's fun.
I think, you know, I'm from with Tom Segura, and he has a second Netflix special release. But first one he financed, and after he had final product, he knew someone. Somehow that thing made it to Netflix. They liked it. But I read that when he was filming the first special, he literally had to grab people and maybe give them a free beer to fill up the seats, you know. But you don't notice that when you watch the special. Mm-hmm. So I think, I mean, have you thought about maybe even just financing it and just film it, the whole thing? And
then, I've done one. I have one now, but I haven't. I mean, I just sell them after shows, but I've never. I don't know who you're supposed to give it to.
Well, let's
and Joan didn't call anybody because I didn't ask her. So. Smothers Brothers didn't call anybody because I didn't ask them to. But I have an hour long DVD that I was done with three cameras and pretty good audience that's good production quality on it.
Well, come on down, you know, because the only major comic I know of that have any pull is Dave Attell and Russell Peters, mm-hmm. you know, and I definitely want to. Well, since you met him, when did you meet him about?
Russell?
Yeah.
2 years ago in Hong Kong.
I wish he would have dropped my name. Yeah. He would have gone even an extra mile. He'll make fun of me for 20 minutes.
Right, then. Sure.
No, I want to do that because...
Well, I appreciate it. I'll come down. I would love to.
I want to definitely... and especially people that are hearing me, so I'm making a private pledge on this, you know, to public pledge everyone that when he's doing Brea, Ontario, Irvine, or even Cobbs... When he's mm-hmm. doing like multiple, like 7, 8, 10 shows, I definitely want to get you on it and
MC.
Yeah, because I met people that without money but overnight success and they become rich, and they turn out to be jerks. Money didn't make those people jerks; they were always jerks.
Yeah,
money
absolutely.
Money exposed them. Mm-hmm. And Russell was not that guy. He never used money to humiliate you. All he's ever done is help his family and friends and. He's one of those guys. He definitely wants success for everyone, you know. I remember he put Joe Coy opening for him, and he's a motherfucker to follow.
Right.
You know, he's one of the few guys on Tonight Show got a standing ovation. But wow. Russell wanted to help motivate him to make more money, and the fact that when you have a strong act opening for him, it makes him work harder. So
right.
He's one of those guys, all around great guy. And, yeah, I would like to definitely want to see you doing Montreal next year.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, I think I belong there. I'm confident of that. You know, I think it's...
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I mean, and Kermit... this is like part Kermit appeal podcast, but no, he's opening for Brian Regan. Like, mm-hmm. you guys are opening for the great headliners. Really, capital and national headliners. And believe me, they don't put some jokers in front of them, you know? So... So what else was going with you? I know you travel. I mean, your wife is healthy. Your kids are doing well.
Yeah.
And I mean, what do you do for fun? I mean, besides doing stand up and stuff.
I go to yoga almost every day. Hot yoga, 90 minutes. I went this morning. I go as much as I can.
How did that start?
I just got tired of running. My legs were getting beat up and sore, and I just was looking for something else. I'll tell you the other reason why hot yoga appeals
to me. Is this
the
Burkham? What's his name?
Yeah, Bikram.
Bikram, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And because when I exercise, when I run, I sweat like a motherfucker. I'm the wettest guy. I'm the guy in the gym where people go, ugh. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm like, ugh, look at that guy sweat. So I'm really conscientious of when I'm on a treadmill in a gym, like, oh, I'm just disgusting. I sweat like this. So I thought, oh, Bikram would be great because everybody's sweating like that. Nobody cares.
But what's the theory on that? It sounds miserable. How hot is it inside?
Yesterday, we were complaining about the heat. Actually, because it was too hot in there,
yeah.
And it was 109, and the humidity was about 50% humidity. It's normally about 104 degrees, about 40% humidity.
Yeah,
and you're just pouring sweat. I lose 4 or 5 pounds every class. I mean, you drink it right back on when you rehydrate, but I can easily drop 4 or 5 pounds in a class, just sweat.
And, I mean, what's the theory behind
that?
Well,
the heat makes you really flexible, and then your body's trying to cool itself, so it's working hard. I was shocked the first time I ever was in that class that your heart rate can get that high without ever leaving the towel. You're just standing on a towel the whole time. But you're doing this series of poses with a short rest in between, and pretty soon your heart rate's way up, and you're like, I thought I had to run to get my heart rate up like that, but you don't have to. And I loved it. So I've been doing it a lot. So anyway, to answer your question, I do a lot of yoga.
And how long have you been doing that?
4 years.
Holy shit.
And I go,
you fit in very well in LA because they love their yoga stuff
down
there.
Yeah. No, I love going.
So what, have you thought of maybe even move, now that your kids are out of the house?
Yeah, actually, I thought about it a little bit because we're going to relocate. We're going to downsize. We have a house that was too big for four people. Now it's way too big for two people. So, yeah, we're going to locate and we can go wherever we want to go.
I hope you move to LA. I think that will make it so much easier, you know. And you have a lot of friends down there as well. And it'll be easier for them to call up last minute to get you on. But I wouldn't let age thing bother you,
no.
man. No, because...
Well, I'm young for my age. I mean, I know that's cliche, but I feel like that. Physically.
You know, the last few times when I saw you, I thought you could play Goldwater in...
I'm dead ringer for him. It's funny you say that. Barry Goldwater, right?
Yeah, I love Barry Goldwater.
Do you? You know who he is? I mean, I'm surprised you know you're too young to know who he is. I on the Mathis shows, I always say, I know a lot of you are looking at me going, this guy is a dead ringer for Barry Goldwater. And it kills because that audience is so old. And if you look at pictures, I have people come up and tell me all the time, anybody ever told you you look just like Barry Goldwater? And I look at pictures
of
him.
Okay, so I wasn't stereotyping because
But I've looked at pictures of Barry Goldwater. I go, oh, my God, I look just like him. I've actually thought about trying to write a one-man show. Kind of basically him scolding this current group of Republicans going, this is not what I had planned.
Yeah.
This is not what I believe in as far as I was, you know, he's apparently the father of conservatism and the new conservative movement. And I've thought about writing a one-man show and just seeing if I could play that or because I do look like him. I know I look like him. Even when I look at the pictures, I go, whoa, I do look like him.
I'm a little torn what's going on in politics in the States.
Oh, yeah.
Because I guess I'm more one of those kind of half libertarian, half Republican foreign policy kind of guy.
Right.
Even though Nixon was such a dishonest person, I love his foreign policy. But in the central part of it, I always loved Barry Goldwater because he was so honest as a politician, mm-hmm. you know. And going down in Arizona, it's weird. My friend Jill. She is a stand-up comic, very funny, and she is Jimmy Kimmel's sister.
Mm.
And they all used to live in Arizona. I think one of her best friends is Barry Goldwater's granddaughter or something, you know.
Well, I met his granddaughter when she ran for her and Stephanie Miller ran for president like 12 years ago or something. Cece Goldwater.
Oh, yes, now I remember, yeah.
Yeah, and I met her one time. So I know who you're talking about. I don't know if it's the same granddaughter or not.
But it'll be fun if you come down to, like, Phoenix. I know there's, I think, something like Goldwater Institute or Goldwater Library.
Right.
But, yeah, I think it'll be fun.
Just stand out in front of the theater. I should just walk around the theater and film that. Start talking to people.
But you might want to...
I've always wondered. I wonder if there's a movie being made anytime, any place in Hollywood where Goldwater's in it. You know what I mean? I wonder if that... Because I'd love to audition for it because I've acted. I've been in a couple independent films and stuff. I know what I'm doing. I'd love to do it.
It'll be great because... what is it? First Tuesday of November is the election. But
right.
There's got to be somebody in the party. I have nothing really personally against Trump, but there's... I just cannot believe what's going on with that party right now.
I should have went to the Republican convention and just stood outside there and just started asking people, what the hell's wrong with you? Barry Goldwater wants to come here. Barry wants to talk to you.
Because that speech that he made, what is the famous saying? In the defense of liberty, something about...
I don't know a lot of what is... But I know that his vision for the Republican Party is nothing to what it is now.
No, he was a very principled man who believed in balancing the budget, strong armed forces,
right.
And
smaller government, like that. Yeah.
And he said that you don't have to be straight to shoot straight, you know,
right.
You know,
exactly.
Defending the gay people. And I think one of his grandkids was a gay,
mm-hmm.
and Lyndon Johnson's group attacking him as some kind of racist. He wasn't. That guy used to fly his little plane around to different reservations and help Native Americans
right.
in Arizona. And he was socially open-minded guy, very conservative when it regarded to foreign policy and mm-hmm. national defense. He loved his country, and I mean, he was so honest. He said Nixon was the most dishonest person he's ever worked with, and I think his problem was he was too honest to be a politician, and I think just like you and Kermit, you guys are not shameless. I think right. that was the problem, you know, but yeah, like, I always hear that, like, why? How do you like Goldwater? Like, you just read history after a while, and there's a certain character that you just learn to admire. He was not a practical man.
Well, now listening to you talk and me talk, now I'm motivated to get out and do something about this look-alike. I should take advantage of it.
It would be funny to film something where, you know, what was that shit that they did in those rap show where they put a hologram of certain star that's been dead for a while
right.
and they start singing, but yeah, you probably just need some, either you write or somebody write something political that Barry Goldwater say now
right.
to the Republican Party. And I think he still is well loved. I mean,
oh, yeah, I think so.
In it's Arizona.
Just, yeah.
John McCain. I remember some people got mad at John McCain like 8, 10, 12, whenever he said the word gook or something.
Oh, right.
I, as an Asian American, was not offended at all, because here's a man who was a prisoner of war in Vietnam. He was giving free passage to leave because they knew he was Emerald Sun.
Right.
He said, unless everyone else get to leave, I refuse to leave. And mm-hmm. they beat the shit out of him a few more years,
right.
you know. And he's a great American. And we're only lucky for him, someone like that, to call us gook, you know. And
I remember that, too. I go, hey, if anybody has a right to harbor some anger, it's John McCain, as far as he gets to hold on to that anger.
Yeah, and he wasn't saying out of anger. It was right. like a conversation that right. Those are the, you know, words that they were using in 60s and 70s
right.
and yeah, I'm socially liberal, but I like that kind of dry conservatism mm-hmm. in Arizona, you know. But Goldwater, when you read, he was very principled, and you just like him. And the older he got, you know, I think he died in 96 or 97.
Yeah.
And
I'm impressed that you know who he is, just because you're so young. Most people have no idea. If they're under 50, they have no idea who he is. Same way with Johnny Mathis. When I tell people, there's so many people have no idea who Johnny Mathis
is. Well, it made me laugh, because every Christmas I would go and visit my friend Rick Tonight Show, and every December he was there. So
yeah.
I didn't know, but now you explained everything I need to
right.
know. Yeah, I hope you do. You don't really do political humor, do
no,
you?
I don't do any of it.
It's probably not practical, right?
No, it just alienates half the audience every mm-hmm. time. You know, it's hard to do.
So what now? Do you have any big shows coming up? Or
I've got some more Mathis dates. I have 2, 5, I have 7 of those booked in the next few months, and then I got some cruise work coming up. Same thing, about 5 or 7 cruise dates. I'm going to do the Big Sky Comedy Festival in October. I got asked to do that, turned it down. I kept getting asked over and over. Okay. And I think somebody from The Tonight Show and somebody from Montreal is going to be at that thing. That's why I decided to do it. I think somebody from Conan is going to be there too.
Okay.
That's why I finally went, okay, I might as well.
And I think I'm releasing this in a couple weeks, but if you're going to New York City, you should go and check out Comedy Cellar. And if you see Jim Norton or David Tell, drop my name.
Yeah.
Yeah. You should go. I mean, you're that caliber, man. I mean,
well, I appreciate it.
I mean, and I know some people do a clean show because they're only talking about marketability, but I mean, you guys, you do that because that's your humor, you and Kermit. And
well, you know, I've told people you'd ask me about in the future. I've actually had this idea to just create a different name and start writing my Louis C.K. type of act.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and just trying to get some dates as a feature act. And my name's Bradley John. That's my Bradley John Upton. And I've just thought about going as John Bradley.
Really?
And then just having a new 30-minute set, you know what I mean? That's darker and nastier and meaner.
Did you kind of want to do that kind of stuff?
Now, there's certain things I'd like to do. This is the other thing, when you've been doing it as long, and I have a following. I go to places, people in Seattle, I got a lot of people. I'm always impressed with how many people come out and they go, oh, we're fans of yours. We've been coming to see you for years and stuff. But they expect to see me. So if I come out and start doing something dark and nasty, I feel like they're like, well, that's not...
You're going to lose
that's not the Brad Upton we love. And I go, so I kind of feel pressured to stay in that kind of genre that I do now. But I would like, there's other subjects that I would like to write about and dark, you know what I mean? And kind of dark, nasty shit that I'd like to do. And then just be John Bradley and go out and get some work as John Bradley. And I mean, that's what Louis C.K. did, right? He just threw away his whole act and went, I'm tired of this.
I don't know what changed because... You know, my friend Jim Norton was on his Lucky Louie. I didn't really know Louie that much. I knew he was a big deal. But when I showed up, and, man, I was blown up. Because he, a couple shows he did warm-up, he just did his act. And he's just a hilarious guy. And he's always working on new material, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was even saying that period between 2007 after losing his... Was it 2006 or 7? When Lucky Louie was not renewal till 2011, he literally had new hour each year.
Wow.
You know, and
that's unbelievable.
And I saw him at Aspen Comedy Festival with Russell and Jim, and the guy's just brilliant mind.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's not even just joke, but like point of view. I mean, only other, there's a couple other people watching stand up over the years, like Russell. What he does so great, in my opinion, people who traditionally never went to stand-up comedy show, they're there now. He's really changing their sense of tasteful stand-up, you know? And some people might complain he's too clean or not edgy, but when you have 18,000 people in your show, and he's slowly putting these kind of edges... I mean, I was surprised first time he was doing a masturbation joke, because there's two Indian father and son kind of thing, and he put them in a spot, but... Russell's audience loved getting picked on him because he's always flattering. He never attack you, make you feel bad about your background.
Right.
So the fact that he's bringing this edgy stuff to them, because they were usually never go to comedy shows. Mm-hmm. So he's really changing the taste of stand-up in those different ethnic groups. Louis and Attell, you know, their materials are fucking incredible.
Yeah, but you're right. It's their point of view, too. They can just sit down and start telling a story, and it's hilarious. Tana's that way, too. Yeah. Tana's the same way. Can just tell a story, and it's just the way it comes out. There's enough jokes in it, and it's great. That you know, Paula Poundstone is one of those people that just can tell a story, and it's outstanding.
Because I think, you know, if you're doing edgy material... If you look it on a piece of paper, their material, and if you just read that part, you think you need to call the police or something.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But I think when you're a good performer, you're able to keep your likability even if you're saying some horrible
shit. Exactly.
And I think that's where funny comics are great. And so you, Kermit, Rod, for me, Mitch Hedberg was another one.
Yeah.
You know, Mitch was very modest. You know, you could tell that whole Scandinavian background from Minnesota. You know, he just... never brag about anything. And when you, I remember that competition that he did late 90s after first night, everybody said, okay, who's going for the second place? Because it was so obvious that he's going to win the whole fucking thing. You
right.
know? And Jim Norton, another honest guy, was shocking to me because he was so honest about it. And finally, the guy that really shocked me as a performer, of course, there's obvious one like Seinfeld and Chris Rock. Patrice O'Neill, man, I don't know if you ever saw him live.
No, I never saw him live.
I'm really never seen anything like that in my life because he never, every show was different.
Wow.
He just starts talking and just fresh point of view, you know.
I think exactly.
I would have been afraid trying to do not something new every night.
I saw Tana one night after he got out of jail. He'd been in jail for 2 weeks. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Which times?
Well, yeah. Well, one of the nights he was with me when he got thrown into jail. That's a good story, too. But it was after he'd been in jail for 2 weeks. And he got out, and he went up that night at Giggles.
And he talked about the whole incident, right?
Yeah, and it was brilliant. He just got up and told a 20-minute story about his previous 2 weeks And I remember thinking, I was dying laughing, just him telling the story of where he'd been the last 2 weeks. And it was brilliant comedy, never been done before. He just told 20-minute story about his 2 weeks in jail. I wish it had been filmed. It was unbelievable. I was just like, he's unbelievable how good, I mean, to tell that story and make it that funny.
And some people say, like, he didn't really want him as bad as others. I don't think even that, there was not even question how funny that guy was. He's so natural. Even Terry Taylor, and Tana doesn't like the guy, would say the most naturalist person he's ever seen do comedy Pacific Northwest, Tana.
Yeah. Oh, I would agree with that. And that's probably why it was so easy, or just not a challenge, or it wasn't. It was just who he is.
He didn't like.
So it probably doesn't interest him as much.
He didn't like the culture down in L.A., mm-hmm. which the way they treat some of the comedians, it's Comedy Magic Club, unbelievable.
Right.
I'm never seeing. I mean, I think their equivalent in East Coast is Comedy Cellar.
Yeah.
But I have to say, Comedy Magic Club, I've never seen a club treat comedians that they do. You know, they're just so respectful of art. They would never allow comedians being accused of stealing other people. Those people are never performing Comedy Magic Club. Mm-hmm. And Mike Lacy, right, the owner,
right.
and
mm-hmm.
Richard, the GM. I mean, to me, Comedy Magic Club is... It's oh, that's my brother. It's kind of like Pittsburgh Steelers, New York Giants, you know, the organization
right.
like that. You know,
right.
they have so much respect for that art. But, yeah, so I hope... I hope you come back to L.A.
Yeah, I will. I'll make more of an effort. You've always offered things to me. I'm the same. You know, you told me.
I didn't really deliver, though. I introduced you to people at the Tonight
yeah,
Show.
Yeah, you always do. But and I always think the same. Oh, he's just being nice. He's just saying that to be nice. And then I don't follow up on it. I mean, I've been down to L.A. enough, and I don't contact you. And it's just, you know, I think, oh, he's just being nice.
I think for me...
now I'm going to push.
I think it, for me, it's more of I just need to see your kids see you on TV.
I'd love that.
That's fun. So how could they follow you? Do you tweet or Instagram something? They could just kind of follow
you? Yeah,
I'm
on Instagram. B up to, my name's Brad Upton, so it's B up to no good. That's my name on there. But Brad Upton, I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter, but I still don't get it. I mean, I do, but I don't tweet much, but I'm on there.
And you're bradupton.com for your
website?
Yeah,
bradupton.com, and that's my website. My schedule's on there.
I think you should definitely figure out a trip down to LA, but maybe even email Arizona. I think it's in Scottsdale at the Goldwater thing.
Yeah, the museum. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We should go down there and film that. Just put on some Goldwater glasses and go stand out on the front porch and talk to people.
I think them
freak out.
I think that party...
They need to hear from Barry.
He definitely hated those religious fanatics.
Absolutely.
And he didn't like all those ugly talk about gay people.
Mm-hmm.
This is a party of... they're a student of history and conservatism, you know, and it's very sad. I can't even imagine what Barry Goldwater would think.
Exactly.
I mean, it's...
That's the point of view I was thought about writing a one-man show. It's just him scolding the current GOP, going, what have you done?
He would definitely not approve about attack on Muslims.
Exactly.
You know, all those, almost 50 people got murdered in Orlando, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the victims were Dominicans and Puerto Ricans, I think.
Right.
And it's just a very sad story. But no surprise, some of the religious people within that community say it's very sad, but they live a life of sin.
Exactly.
And
that
doesn't mean they agree with what the murderers did, but still that kind of negative, just a terrible way of thinking, you know. And I think a guy like Barry Goldwater would just absolutely be appalled by
mm-hmm.
that kind of talk.
Absolutely. Well, we all should be. But you're right. Goldwater would be.
All right. Well, Brad, thanks for doing it.
Yoshi, great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's always
good to see you.
I want everybody to see your act, and you should definitely come down. I think it would be good for you and your daughter. And Congratulations, your son graduating.
Thank you, sir.
And I hope he got the job today. What, you don't have to say the name of the place in interviewing, but he had an interview today.
Yeah, he did have an interview today with a very well-known company.
And was he a finance major or what was it?
Yeah, a business major.
Okay, good. Yeah. I'm sure he'll do well.
Yeah, he'll do great.
Does he have any interest in comedy?
No. My daughter, maybe. My daughter's funny, but my son, no. I don't think that's his career path.
She should think about it, and then we'll finish with this.
Okay.
I remember years ago going to dinner with Jim Norton, and I think this was a little before he was dating Chelsea Peretti. And when I met her, I didn't even know she was a stand-up comic. I know she was writing for some video game company, a blog mm-hmm. or something. Very funny and a good writer, but she was writing during the day, and now she's on sitcom and doing hour special. So you never know. But exactly. I highly recommend you come down because
all right.
I think it'll help her see writing job options,
All right.
All right. All right, Brad, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll see you guys. And thanks for listening. And I'll talk to you guys soon.